This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodl Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
You may have heard that astronomers at Jodl Bank have cracked the Fried Egg Nebula. Here to talk to us about this today is our director and our boss, Albert Zylstra. So, Albert, can you tell us why is it called the Fried Egg Nebula?
The opinions on this differ. One of the newspapers thought it was because the observer was very hungry when he found this particular object. It was named by Eric Lagerdeck. He was a postdoc here before. And when it came off the telescope, and that is 2 years ago, it really looked like a fried egg. He showed me the image straight away, and it was quite amazing. I've never seen anything quite like it. It is, of course, interesting that someone who's French come up with this name. He's clearly had spent too long in England.
And what does the image look like?
It shows the star in the center, and there are two rings, two shells around it. In the original version that Eric made, the inner one, the inner two shells, was yellow. And the outer one was white, which makes it even more look like a fried egg. He slightly cheated on the color table, though.
Just to really make it look like a fried egg in this image.
Actually, in the image I've seen, the outer bit looks a bit uncooked.
It looks a bit ragged. Yes. That is true, and it's just what the shell is like.
So, what was it called before the Fried Egg Nebula?
It didn't have a particular name. It was known as an IRA source. It's quite an interesting IRA source because it's one of the 30 brightest in the sky, and no one had looked at it in any detail.
So that's why you chose to study this particular one?
It was in a catalogue of possible post-AGB stars. The post-AGB stars is a very short phase of evolution where a star ejects its envelope and then evolves towards the planetary nebula phase. Objects in between are quite rare because it's such a short phase, and it has been called the missing million years of stellar evolution. Now, one of our co-authors had made a catalogue of possible objects in this phase, and we observed all objects in that catalogue while we were at the VLT.
So you took these pictures at the VLT, and I heard that it was one of the driest nights ever at the VLT up in Paranal. Why was that good for the observations?
We observe in the mid-infrared, which is a very difficult wavelength range to observe because the sky is so bright. Mm. It is like having all your lights left on inside your dome, and it's always like that. Now, the drier the sky, the air, the more stable the observations become, and this was really an extremely stable night.
So what do the observations show about the object?
It didn't show anything that we were expecting. We were looking for asymmetries in shells. It turns out this one is as round as they come. We were looking for post-AGB stars, and after 2 years of studying it, we decided it wasn't one. It was much more distant than we had thought, and it was a supergiant, not an AGB star. In fact, an even rarer phase of stellar evolution.
I think I read that it was a yellow hypergiant. What exactly is a yellow hypergiant, and how giant is it?
It's pretty giant. It is not the biggest star I've ever observed. That was one that we called the Monster, which we discovered 15 years ago. And that one would fill the solar system to beyond the orbit of Saturn. This one is a little bit smaller. Jupiter would find itself close to the surface of the star if it had been at the position of the Sun. It's in a phase of evolution where a supergiant, and that's the star with a mass maybe 20, 30 times the mass of the Sun, begins to eject its envelope before it finally turns into a supernova. And you've got in sequence there where it's a red supergiant, yellow supergiant, blue supergiant, bang. And it might be a Wolfrier star in between as well.
So these stars are losing lots of material in these stellar winds, are they? And sort of how much material are they losing?
We believe that they lose a lot of mass, but not a whole lot is known about it. The one that we found in the Large Magellan Cloud, which we called the Monster, was classified as a very ordinary giant. And because it lost so much mass, it was completely obscured. And people had missed that fact, and so thought it was far less luminous than it really was. And so a lot of these kind of objects are hidden behind the dust that they make themselves. This one has a reasonable extinction, but not as high as you might expect. And it's a good thing, because I actually see the darn thing.
So this Fried Egg Nebula is a yellow hypergiant surrounded by two shells of dust that have been ejected from it in its final stage of life before it goes supernova. And how likely is it to go? Is it going to go supernova soon if it's going towards this stage?
Oh, it will certainly go supernova within the next few million years. Very soon.
So it's one to watch then?
You'll have to watch it for a while. Of course, it's not the only object in the Milky Way like this. There are not so many. It is, I think, in the top 20 or so of brightest stars in the Milky Way that we know about. There is an even brighter one nearby, Eta Carina. This is closer to us, and that one is likely to go bang first, I think. Or if it goes bang, it will be more impressive. The fried egg is hidden behind a fair amount of dust between us and the star, and even when it blows up, the explosion might not be as impressive as you might have wished.
And that's the reason why we've not observed this yellow hypergiant before, despite how luminous it is normally.
Yeah, there are several reasons. One is the extinction from dust in the Milky Way. And the other thing is that the Milky Way is a very crowded region. There are a lot of stars there. And so it's very easy to miss things that are very interesting. And this is spot in the plane of the Milky Way. And so there is an awful lot of confusion. If it hadn't been for the IRAS detection, no one would have picked this up as anything interesting.
And you mentioned before it took you 2 years to realise what type of object it was. Why was this the case?
It was very hard to determine the distance to the object. We couldn't do that from the Vizier, the VLT observations themselves. We had to get a spectrum. In that spectrum, we found evidence for absorption along the line of sight between us and the star. And from the velocity range of that absorption, we could see that it could not be at 1 kiloparsec, 3,000 light years, that it was supposed to be. It had to be much further away. We finally settled on a distance between 4,000 and 5,000 parsec.
So it was likely to be much brighter than we previously understood.
That made it a lot brighter than we first thought, and it turned it from a post-HGB star into a supergiant.
Going back to these shells, what are they made of? I think you mentioned they were made of dust. What kind of dust is this? It's obviously not the stuff our hoovers pick up.
No, and it's not made out of egg yolk either. So the stuff that we see is indeed dust, which are very small particles, solid particles, which you find in space. And these ones condensed in the wind from the star. And they consist of magnesium, silicon, oxygen. The closest that you can get to it that we know about is sand. So in a way, this star is surrounded by its own sandstorm. It has in fact three shells, not two. You only see two, but when we looked at in detail at the data, it turns out that the star itself that we saw in the images was not the star. We saw an other shell that was obscuring the star itself. And so there is a very compact shell around the star, pretending to be the star itself.
So how old are these shells?
Yeah, they're not that old. They're ejected in the last couple of hundred years.
Well, that's very short on the lifetime of a...
It's a very short thing. And it happens with stars in this... this phase of stellar evolution. For instance, P Cygnus is another star in this phase, and we know that had an eruption about 500 years ago. Aegea Carina is a star in this phase. Eta Carina also has had several eruptions, but Eta Carina is more luminous. It is not quite the same type of star. But clearly, in this particular phase of evolution, the stars become quite unstable, and it doesn't take much to make them eject a lot of gas.
So how much is a lot of gas?
This particular star seems to have ejected about 4 solar masses in its recent history. If it started out as maybe 25, 30 solar masses, which we don't quite know, that is a significant fraction of the star that was ejected.
So it's 4 times the mass of our sun that's just blown off this huge star.
That is correct, yeah.
And what suddenly causes these massive mass loss periods?
We don't know. There is clearly an instability in there. In the case of Eta Carina, which had an eruption, of 2 eruptions even, in the 1800s, it looks like that star is a binary. And whenever the companion gets close to the star itself, it happens every 5 years, there is a chance of an ejection. So it seems to be binary-induced in that particular case. But what induces it in other stars, we really have no idea.
And do these other stars show asymmetries, and this one is just perfectly spherical? Or is it a case that they're all spherical in their shells around the central star?
Eta Carina is not spherical at any scale. That shows beautiful bipolar lobes coming out. In this particular example, we believe that this one is not spherically symmetric either. It looks very nicely symmetric on the images, but it may be because the ejection happens in the plane of the sky. And if you look in a bipolar nebula, see the pole on, it will look very spherically symmetric. In this particular case, we have some evidence on polarization that there is some asymmetry present.
So do you think then it's bipolar along the line of sight, or that it's actually flat against the plane of the sky, like a fried egg?
It may be a fried egg in more than one way. I would expect, though, that there is a faster ejection along the polar axis that's coming towards us and moving away from us. But we don't see strong evidence for that.
So it's a bit like looking at a Smarties tube. So at one end, you see just the circular face of it. Whereas if you'd looked at the side, what's really going on, you've got a whole long tube of Smarties, and that's sort of an analogy to describe the nebula.
Yeah, maybe not quite as impressive analogy as a fried egg, but a Smarties tube, we'll keep that in mind for our next nebula that we discover.
You have to make an impressive colour table for Smarties.
This interview's starting to make me hungry. So might there be more shells beyond those that we can see already?
Yes, we see evidence from that from coal dust. We haven't imaged that. We have some information from the IRAS data, which extend to 1600 microns, so much longer wavelength than we can image from the ground. And that shows an excess emission over the models that we made for this object. And there must be colder dust further out. But we don't know whether that is as part of another shell. It might be as part of interstellar medium dust that's being swept up by the wind from this star. There could be a variety of explanations.
We might see these shells in longer wavelengths, sort of the millimeter range. Is that a job maybe for ALMA? Or?
We certainly would like to observe this object with ALMA, but half the world wants to observe at ALMA, so it's very hard to get time on that. At the moment, we're trying to focus more into the central object itself. We've applied for time on the Very Large Telescope interferometer, an optical interferometer, to try to resolve the star itself and to get into this central core, this dust-star mix that seemed to be right at the center of our nebula.
So far, we can only tell about the shells surrounding the hypergiant in the center. We don't really know much about the central star. And what does these observations tell us about the object?
The observation that we have tell us that the object is very luminous, very unstable. We know the stellar temperature reasonably accurately, so that's how we know it's a yellow hypergiant. What we would like to know is the abundances. What kind of elements are coming out of the star? A massive star should be quite efficient in making nitrogen. Do we see that? So we'd like to get a detailed spectrum of the star. We would like to see what happens with this dust right at the position of the star itself. Is that a new shell that's being formed at the moment? Is that dust that was left behind when the rest of the shells were rejected? Is it maybe the polar outflow that we just see projected onto the star? So there is a variety of questions that we still like to answer about this object.
So the production of dust is quite an important topic. Perhaps you could tell us why it's kind of important in a more galactic scale or beyond just the realm of the star itself.
The dust in the universe is a nightmare. It hides so many things from view. It is opaque, so you can't see through it. There are regions in the galaxy where you got something like 100 magnitudes of extinction. Well, that means just not bothering opening the dome of your telescope. That adds about that much extinction to your line of sight. So there are places that we can't see anything, and it seems all the interesting bits are hidden by the dust. But the dust itself is also useful to us. The Earth is made out of that kind of dust. If you don't have the dust to begin with, you can't make the rocky planets. And so it works both ways. The dust that we have in the universe comes primarily from old stars, evolved stars. And in this particular context, the yellow hypergiant here is an old star. And so these stellar winds, which make stars die, are also the place where the dust grains are formed.
So these stellar winds are also important for driving star formation then as well? Or do they have the kind of effect that supernova shockwaves have when they kind of gather up dust to create stars?
There is a lot of energy that comes out of these stars. They're very luminous. Even though there are very few of these stars, they account for a significant fraction of the total luminosity of a galaxy. So they also have a lot of effect on their environment. Because they're young, because they don't live very long, they're still surrounded by the remnants of the cloud from which they formed. And the stellar winds from these stars can compress these clouds. Now, whether that triggers star formation is a good question. It might also cause more turbulence in the interstellar medium. We see that in some of our modeling of the stellar wind interface with interstellar medium. And in that case, it might actually suppress star formation, because turbulence is quite an important parameter that governs star formation. So we really don't know what the effect is. Triggered star formation is a very popular model these days, but it does need confirmation.
So where next for studies like this? What do you hope to go on to do?
And this object was a bit of an accidental find. We hadn't expected a yellow hypergiant. We weren't interested in yellow hypergiants to begin with. We are now. But our main goal of the research is still to find out how the post-AGB stars evolve. So to fill in this missing million years of stellar evolution. It's not a million years, it's only about 10,000 years that's missing. But one of the things that happens there is that the structures that you see in planetary nebulae form. So all these bipolar shells, these beautiful structures, the rings of the ring nebula, they form somewhere in this phase of evolution. The stars that eject these nebulae are round. As far as we can tell, the winds that come off these stars are round. So at what point do you start to deshape, deform a round nebula into the structures that we see in planetary nebula? That is still a major problem to resolve. And that is the one we want to get back to now that we've solved the problem of the Friedeck.
So planetary nebula, are they quite different structures to the one that we're looking at in the Friedeck nebula? Or are they somewhat similar in the mechanism that produces them?
They're very similar. In fact, all cool stars that are in this phase of evolution, whether normal mass stars like an ACB star or a supermassive star like Eta Carina, seems to lose mass in very similar ways. The dusty winds and the structures are very similar, which is one of the reasons it took us 2 years to find out whether this was a post-ACB star or a hypergiant. We know it now. But clearly the physics that goes on and the physics of the shaping is very similar in both group of objects.
So what will this nebula go on to become as it, and the star itself, what will that go to next as it evolves further?
At some stage, we expect it to lose so much of its mass that most of the hydrogen in the star is gone. And you begin to expose the regions in the star where the abundances have been changed by nuclear burning, the nuclear fusion. When that happens, the star becomes more like a Wolfarié star, as it is called. It becomes much hotter, so it is many 10,000s of degrees on the surface temperature. It has no longer shows much hydrogen. It will still have a strong wind, but much faster than the wind it has at the moment. The next phase of evolution after that is probably when it blows up as a supernova. But that particular timing of that event is very hard to predict.
And you, as you're looking for protoplanetary nebula and this yellow hypergiant, are the type of material surrounding the stars similar as well?
There is a lot of similarities. These stars are what you call oxygen-rich. Means the abundances are dominated by oxygen, and that means the dust is dominated by oxygen, and which gives you this silicate, this sand structure around it. Around ACB star, you can also get carbon-rich objects, and then the abundances change, and the dust becomes much more like soot, and not at all like sand. The color, the size, everything is different in that kind of dust. You never see that around these supermassive objects like this hypergiant. Those only show the sand type of dust.
And what causes this difference?
It's hard to give a unique answer to that, because even the massive stars can become carbon-rich. The carbon gets formed from the nuclear burning inside the star, so it is self-produced carbon. But massive stars do that well. They just don't do it as well as the lower mass stars. When a star becomes a Wolfarié star, it is carbon-rich. And so even the supermassive stars do become carbon-rich, but at that point in their evolution, they do not produce dust. So there is a difference there between the lower mass stars, like the Sun, and the massive stars, like this object.
So that's an easy way to spot the Wolf-Rayet-type stars, but this earlier stage of evolution is harder to see.
Yes, although even in the Wolf-Rayet-type evolution, you can still have confusion, because the central stars of planetary nebulae go through a phase where they also look like Wolf-Rayet stars. And it took quite a while before people realized how to distinguish the low-mass Wolf-Rayet stars inside planetary nebulae from the high-mass Wolf-Rayet stars, the real ones. And so there is confusion everywhere.
Okay, so I think that about wraps it up. Thank you very much, Albert, for that exciting interview. Sorry, that's an awful joke.
It's a pleasure, but I guess calling an object a fried egg invites these kind of jokes.